Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. And Michter's is the first American whiskey to be selected as Whiskey of the Year by Whiskey Exchange. Michter's, it's all about the whiskey. Welcome to In the Drink, the show where we talk to some of the most interesting people in the beverage industry. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, the owner and wine director of Fausto here in Brooklyn, where we record the podcast every week in the cellar. I also make a little bit of wine in Italy under the label Anona. This week, Anna Martins joins us of Vino Diana. Anna produces some thrilling wines on the active volcano that is Mount Etna. Her wines are unique, they have a ton of personality, they're very distinctive, and we had a great conversation in the wine cellar. So without further ado, here's Anna Martins of Vino Diana. Welcome to the podcast, Anna.
Thanks, Joe.
Can you tell us about how you got into wine and then how you found your site on Mount Etna?
Sure. I'll give you the brief story because I can make a very long story of it. But being Australian and growing up in Adelaide, I was surrounded by wine regions, and at a young age and as a teenager, visited lots of wineries and vineyards with my family, with friends. And when I finished school, it became sort of an obvious thing for me to study oenology and viticulture. So I started my journey in the wine industry many years ago in the 90s, studying at Roseworthy Wine College, and then worked for a winery called Petaluma at that stage. And it was a very exciting time, the Australian wine industries in the 90s, and the world seemed to wake up to the wines, and particularly in the UK and in the US, that, you know, Australia was making very fruit-driven wines, but wines that, also had a personality and, fruit juice bottled. And so, yeah, it was an exciting start to the journey.
And then where did you go next?
Then I traveled around for many years. I've always enjoyed traveling, but I did harvest in the south of France and in Burgundy. I visited Italy for the first time, visiting various wine regions. And then I moved to New Zealand and worked there for a year. And then after that, I sort of basically took on a role as a flying winemaker. By that stage, I'd qualified as a winemaker, and for about 2 years did harvest in the Northern Hemisphere and in the Southern Hemisphere before finally landing in Italy in 2001.
That sounds exhausting.
A lot of fun doing harvest at that stage. And, you're in your 20s and, that's all about working in the land and working with grapes and then turning them into wine. I mean, it's an exciting, exciting time, a lot of adrenaline, but, a lot of partying as well. And just gave me a chance to visit many different countries from, Chile and Argentina to South Africa to France to various parts of Italy and do what I love doing.
And when you arrived in Italy in 2001, did you go straight to Sicily or is there another stop?
No, there's another stop. I lived in Tuscany for about, 7 years. So I was lucky to get an internship at Tenuta di Unalaya, making Super Tuscans. So it was an internship that was meant to last about 6 months. And instead, I ended up working 4 years at Unalaya, working in extraordinary vineyards and, making some of the world's most prestigious wines at that time.
And then from Ornellaia, did you go down to Sicily?
No, the journey took me on to France. And during my last time at Ornellaia in 2004, I met my now husband, Eric Nario, and who's a wine importer and is very passionate about organic and biodynamic farming and sustainability. And at that stage was representing or starting to represent a lot of natural wine producers in France and Italy. So he took me on a journey and said, I understand the wines you're making and the style that you're making of Super Tuscans, but what about having a look to see what's being made currently in the Jura, in the Savoie, in the Loire? So I had a real journey with him to explore a different style of winemaking and farming than what I'd done for the previous sort of 15 years.
That must have been really eye-opening.
Amazing. And I got the opportunity to meet some incredible people and see a different side to the scientific approach that I'd had to make wine.
What did you learn from your time at Ornellaia that you can use for your wines of Vino Diana? Because they're such different, both in size, scale, scope, price, but also, I don't know Ornellaia's farming very well, but it's not at least part of the story that the organic and biodynamic farming.
I was lucky to be at Ornellaia at a time where there was a change happening, that it was moving from the Antonori family and that the Mondavis were coming on board. It was the time when Mondovino was shot while I was working at Ornellaia. So I was with some very passionate people, some very renowned people in the wine industry internationally. And so it exposed a whole global side to the industry that I hadn't had before working for smaller producers. And I think that gave me, on a business sense, an idea that I hadn't had in my previous winemaking positions. But with regards to the work in the vineyard and the cellar, I was the assistant to Thomas Duraud, who's now the manager of Chateau Palma in Bordeaux. And Thomas taught me a lot about sort of attention to detail, about precision. At Ornellaia, we went to meticulous details in the vineyards of isolating certain patches, certain soil types. Some vineyards had certain issues that other parts of the vineyard didn't. And so I suppose Thomas took me from making big quantities of wine and it all going into one label in one bottle, maybe as an Argentinian Malbec. He then took me down to, you know, very precise micro-vinifications of a certain parcel of Cabernet Sauvignon next to a different parcel of Cabernet Sauvignon next to a different clone of Cabernet Sauvignon. And so that has held me well for working on Etna, because Etna is very much about micro-vinifications, in my opinion.
It's super interesting. And then in your all of your previous experience, what have been some of the more influential moments that you've had that inform your outlook? It sounds like this trip through France with...
This trip through France, and I spent quite a few months. I think I had the privilege of meeting Pierre Vanois one afternoon with Eric, and we literally knocked on his back door and he was there in his garden about to have lunch, and he was in his singlet and said, you know, he didn't know who we were, and Eric was there, you know, wanting to see whether he could import some of his wines into the UK. And Pierre sort of said, look, would you like me to join you for lunch? So, you know, he just sees this couple at the door, and he had just made his famous bread and he had a couple of big tomatoes from his garden. And we sat outside and just, you know, spoke to this incredible man who's an enigma. And he was just so humble. And then we were in the area for a few days. He said, oh, you know, we're harvesting. Why don't you come and see us harvest? And there was Pierre, you know, amongst the family and, you know, harvesting and giving his opinion and the generations, you know, that were there helping him work and, you know, making these incredible wines he does. That was a very pivotal moment for me.
What an incredible experience, and certainly his wines have become so renowned and regarded. When, what year was that?
This was in 2005.
Oh, wow. Was Eric able to import his wine?
Absolutely.
Wow. It's amazing. And then how did you find your site on Etna?
On Etna, it's taken us many years to create our little domain on Etna, but we went to visit Etna in 2005. Again, Eric was looking for some wines to import mm-hmm. into the UK. And we drank together during one of the famous evenings at Vinitaly, at Bottega del Vino, some old bottles of Pietramarina Bianco and Calabretta Reds that were sort of, you know, 15 years old in the bottle and still tasted incredibly fresh and like a burger. Burgundy red for the Calabretta, and Pietramarina just had this incredible acidity. So we thought, you know, let's head to Sicily and let's see what's happening on Etna. And we both just fell in love with the island, with the volcano, with the old vines, and thought, you know, maybe one day we could, you know, buy a little vineyard and make one wine together.
Really? And on that first trip? There
on that first trip. And Eric's actually been quoted in a magazine that I didn't know about for many years, of saying he wasn't sure whether the relationship would last, but he knew he wanted to make wine with me on Etna. So
Does he also have winemaking experience or more on the importing side?
Until I met Eric, he hadn't made any wine. Now he's actually very instrumental in making many, many wines and helping various large-scale producers convert either one part of their vineyards to organic, even biodynamic, and, you know, making some cuvées from very good vineyards that until now have been fine, filtered, a lot of manipulation in the cellar. He's sort of asking various people to not do that and then saying he will buy those wines for the UK and other markets. So his actual winemaking journey really started with me in 2008. But if anything, today he definitely makes much more wine and is more influential on many more styles than I am.
Wow. And so how do you divide the responsibilities at the vineyard? Is that difficult?
It's not difficult. We both have different skill sets, but we try and be as interchangeable as possible. The work that's done in the vineyard is probably more led by him. He has an incredible vision and sees things more than I probably do, particularly with the relation to viticulture. In the winery, on the technical side and sort of the scientific side, I mean, that's obviously my strength and what I've sort of studied and how I've made wine for 20 years. But we have different palates and we come from very different backgrounds, but we try and sort of bounce ideas off each other and it somehow works.
And what was the first vintage of Vino Diana?
The first wine we made for Vino Diana was 2008.
2008. And from the beginning, were you fully convinced this should be a wine made without chemicals, made in the style that you make it today? Or is
absolutely. Yeah.
Has there been an evolution at all?
No, it was always going to be, it had to be. I mean, I was the winemaker for someone else in 2008 down on Etna. And for Vino Diana, it was always to be one wine, hence Vino Diana. At the stage, I was the only one making the wine. Eric was in the UK, but I was living on Etna, you know, working for someone else. And the idea was to make 1,000 bottles. Now, 11 years later, we have 6 hectares and we make probably 40,000 bottles a year.
Wow. So,
and that's definitely Eric's vision that I've joined, and it's just, yeah, addictive.
And as you've grown, how has Etna changed?
Etna's changed extraordinarily. It's really when we first moved to Etna in 2007, there was a lot of abandoned vineyards. There were a lot of disused palmento, so the traditional stone wine building. And the area was quiet and there wasn't a lot of work for the local people. Now, fast forward sort of even just the 10 years, and it's extraordinary. Every piece of land is either being cleared or has been planted. There's new hotels, there's new restaurants, there's new Airbnbs, and it seems half the world is visiting Etna at any one stage.
Would you say this is a good thing? It's brought all this attention?
Definitely a very positive thing. I think, you know, Etna used to have about 100,000 hectares planted to vineyards, and then after the Second World War, when a lot of the population either migrated to the States or to Australia, the whole area of Sicily and particularly Etna was, you know, poverty basically hit. And that's why the vineyards and the land was abandoned. So for now, I think it's just fantastic to see the energy and all that my friends that I've known before kind of the explosion, for a poor choice of word, the activity that's happening there. They're so happy. They're able to, you know, make a living either running a fruit and veg shop or having a small Airbnb, or they had a piece of land that they could now renovate and have turned into a little agroturismo. I mean, it's fabulous.
I can think of, off the top of my head, a few expats who have moved to Etna. Has that continued to be the trend, that people are moving maybe from other countries or even other parts of Italy, like Andrea Franchetti? And
I think, yes, I think, you know, Etna, when, you know, in 2004, 2005, it was really, you know, Andrea Franchetti, Franco Nielsen and Marco De Grazia were probably the three names that you knew outside of the locals, being Calabretta and Bananti. And I think today there are people from all around the world that are making wine. You know, there's even from Sweden, from China, from Japan. They're the small, tiny producers, but a lot of the larger Italian wineries now have done investment on Etna. So people like Planeta, whether it's Sicilian or whether it's a larger producer like Corvo, Tusca della Marita has come across. I think all of that's positive for the region. For me, the one drawback is there's been quite a lot of investments of banks and money that large groups of people that have come and they've changed the landscape, I think, in a negative way. They've often razed old terraces. They've, you know, offered people money to pull out old vineyards that were perfectly, you know, producing vineyards, but they'd have to be farmed by hand, and these bigger organisations want everything to be farmed by machinery. And there's some fairly ugly wine buildings that have been built, which has taken away a lot of the character that drew Eric and I to Etna many years ago.
And when you were drawn there, how did you choose your initial sites? It sounds like you were working as a winemaker for some time. Was it hard to find a site? It sounds like there was some abandoned. Was there some bureaucracy that you had to go through? Was there a challenge, or was it that there was a lot that people were willing to part with and you sort of had your pick?
A combination of all of that. I think, you know, we were lucky in 2007 when we were looking for our first little vineyard to buy that not many people were looking. Today, if you want to find a piece of land, there's a race. There are so many people out there searching, and the prices have gone from things that we would have bought for maybe 10,000 euro a hectare and now 100 to 150,000 hectares. So it depends on how much money you want to put in the project, whether you've received subsidies or outside investment, or whether you're, you know, a small family or a couple that, you know, are wanting to do this as a lifestyle choice. So I think, one, we were very lucky the timing, and two, at that stage when we first were looking in 2008 and 2009, you know, people were actually even approaching us saying, hey, we've got this little parcel of, you know, land, you know, we heard you're starting a little, you know, winery, would you even be interested to come and, you know, maybe buy our land? So but at that stage we were still approached by people. That's not really happening these days. You've got to be pretty quick if you find a piece of land to work out who owns it. And there's normally a battle in regards to the price. How we found our first little piece of land was we had the help of an incredible, generous and humble person called Salvo Forti, who I think is very instrumental as to Etna having a wine industry today. And Salvo kindly introduced us and helped us find our first little plot. And it was rather ironic because that first little vineyard we found happened to be across the road from this beautiful house that I had been wanting to rent, because I saw it was an agriturismo and available for rent for over 18 months. I'd driven past it every day and was unable to find the owners. So when we were looking for vineyards and we got presented this tiny vineyard and it happened to be across from my dream house, it was meant to be. We managed to find out finally who were the owners to that house, and, you know, within the week have bought that vineyard and then have rented this house that's now our home on the part of Vinodiana and the center of the domain.
Wow. I know that Salvo Forti has been such a big proponent and has helped out so many people on Mount Etna. Can you describe what your relationship was like other than him helping you find this vineyard? Did you ever ask him for advice? He seems like was the expert at that time, at least.
Absolutely. And he still is. I mean, Salvo's a very dear friend and, you know, his family, and he's got, you know, two beautiful children, Simone and Andrea. And I think his whites for me are some of the best Italian whites, not Sicilian whites, Italian whites. I mean, I think his wines are extraordinary. He is such a humble, intelligent, beautiful soul, and we met him at a time that was very instrumental to us. Yes, I'd made wine. Yes, Eric was a wine importer, but we hadn't farmed ever old vineyards of Albarello. We'd never worked with Nerello Mascalese, and so Salvo helped us a lot and advised us a lot in the first few years in the vineyards of how to farm and, you know, keep these old vineyards alive. Winemaking styles, we exchange ideas, and still today we exchange ideas. He's got a quavery that we were instrumental in him having in his beautiful property over in Milo. So I very much respect Salvo on all levels. Today, you know, sadly we don't see each other quite so much, because before he was more at his property, which is on our side of Etna. Milo is a good hour away. But I think he often is not given the credit for the number of people he's helped along the way, you know, to set up the vineyards and properties on Etna.
Yeah, he's so instrumental. I'm almost not surprised to hear that he had some hand, some help. Also very cool to hear that you've helped him source a quevery. I wanted to ask you, why did you choose the Georgian name for Quevery, as opposed to maybe something that might seem more logical, like the Italian name of Anfora or Greek name. There's Greek influence in the area. What made you choose the Georgian name for that vessel?
Because our Queveries are actually Georgian. So they've actually come from Georgia. So for us, it made sense to use the correct name for them.
That's a logical answer. And what got you excited and interested in that style? I went to the first annual Quevery conference in Tbilisi, Georgia. Very happy. It was a little tongue-in-cheek because obviously they've been making wine in Quevery for 8,000 years plus. And I find it to be endlessly fascinating. But what got you interested in using this vessel?
We were given the first one as a gift. So from winemaking friends, John Woodeman at Pheasant's Tears and his winemaker Geller, and another very beautiful gentleman, Father Gerishim, that at the time was one of the monks at the Alvederi Monastery in Georgia. Eric went to Georgia to look at Georgian wines and see, you know, what wines that he might be able to work with and help promote in the UK market, and was at a dinner with a bishop from the monastery, and John was present and was discussing, as the Georgians do, family and life. And at the end of the meal, they decided between the group of four men and Eric that were at the table that they would like to offer us a Quevery as a gift for our new winery. So yes, the first one arrived,
wow.
2,000 litres. Actually, there were two of them. Sadly, one was broken during the transit because they had actually just put it on a pallet on a tyre tractor and sent it from Georgia to Sicily. So one didn't make it, but the other one did make it. And John and Geller and Father Gerishim kindly came and buried it for us back in 2012.
Wow, so, that's incredible.
And we had no idea. I mean, you know, we obviously knew of the use of the Quevery. We knew of the history of the Quevery. We never thought to seek to make wine in Quevery at the beginning, back in 2008. Mm-hmm. We were using wood, and, you know, we still do think large format old wood has a very good affiliation with Nerello Mascalese. But when you get offered this gift with all the history behind you, you can not but get excited and think, okay, let's see what, you know, our grapes can do in this Georgian vessel, you know, on the north face of Etna. It was kind of crazy at the time.
And what have the results been?
We're extraordinarily pleased with the wine that was made in 2012. It was a very hot vintage on Etna. And at that stage, we really only had we only had grapes from memory coming from about less than 2 hectares. So literally all of our grapes went in to fill that Quevery because it's such a big vessel for us. And it was, of the few other micro vinifications we did, it was the one wine that finished 100% dry. The alcohol of all the wines that year are over 16%. But of the one wine, and I think almost the one wine from Etna that I've tasted from 212, you don't taste the alcohol that's there. And where a lot of the other Etna reds from 212, the alcohol stands out. Often the wine still had residual sugar. And there was just a purity and a harmony from the wine in the Quevery. And so we set out to go to Georgia and meet one of the few artisan Quevery makers and have some smaller Queveries made for us, which we're using today.
How many do you have today?
Today we have 8.
Wow.
So 8 plus the first one, so we have 9.
It's so special. When I went to Georgia 6 years ago or so, there were not that many artisans of Quevery making left. I think I saw John there as well, and he said maybe there are only 4 or something like that, it's a surprisingly small number. You know, for sure, part of it is at that time there weren't as many people who were interested in making wine in that style in Georgia, but also their level of craftsmanship is so high that they last for so long. They don't have to make that many.
No, it's extraordinary, the Quevery makers. And I think, you know, Zeliko, who started to make our Queveries, when we met him and went there in 2012 and 13, was literally going out of business. It was him and his 2 sons. And at that stage, I think, I agree with you, I'm not too sure whether 3 or 4, but, you know, he was really sort of struggling. And now if you want to have one of his Queveries, which in my opinion are still the best, just because of his craftsmanship and the source of clay he has, I think there's a 2-year waiting list because he can obviously only make so many They're made like you would make as a child, a small pottery. I don't know whether you ever made clay and you had to make an ashtray at the time where you make a long sort of snake, and they're made out of coils, and slowly, slowly, slowly they build them up to the size they need to be. But, you know, to make a medium-sized quavery is at least 3 to 4 weeks' work.
How many of you are using, do you know, are using quavery on Mount Etna at this point?
We and Salvo are the only ones that have quavery. Yes. Wow. I mean, the likes of Frank Cornelissen have amphora, and that's all at this stage.
Still very small.
Yes.
Was 2012 the last time that you reached 16% in alcohol in your wines? I think of the reds of yours I've had as being on the more elegant side and not being those sort of big, brooding, more powerful wines. Is that only a function of nature and how hot 2012 was, or is that also something you're doing intentionally? Have you changed at all towards making kind of fresher, lower alcohol wines?
I think 2012 was a little bit like 2003. Everyone kind of got caught out with the level of ripeness that was happening. It was a very dry year. So the vineyard that we normally harvest, a vineyard called Don Alfio that we purchased in 2010, we normally harvest that vineyard the third week of October. To make the wine that went into the quavery, we'd done the harvest on the 2nd of October. So, you know, even through harvesting the grapes 3 weeks earlier, we still had such crazy levels of sugar. Thankfully, there hasn't been such a hot vintage since then. I think, you know, the weather on Etna is very extreme, very changeable, very dramatic. 2007 was quite a warm vintage, 17, excuse me, but not in the league of 212. Stylistically, to answer the second part of your question, yes, I mean, Eric and I, you know, we like to drink wines that have an acid backbone and a freshness to them. And we both really enjoy a glass of wine. So we don't want to be drinking 15 to 16% alcohol wines. I mean, we like to drink wines throughout the meal and, you know, even before and after. So, you know, the idea is to make a wine that is pure and expressive but has a balance. But we do sort of tend to pick our fruit a little. We're not looking for maximum extraction or late fruit hang. We're wanting everything, our berries, to still have a bounce in them when we pick them. So obviously that's helping keep the sugar levels down and, you know, resulting in lower level of alcohol wines compared to some of our neighbors.
I think the normal conversation is that Etna is capable of producing, or generally produces, more on the Burgundian lighter style wines, but I don't always find that. And I find that in some of your reds, and I really, I love that about your wines. In terms of organic viticulture, do you feel that you're an outlier on Mount Etna in your approach to viticulture, or do you have many other growers who you can ask an opinion to because you respect that they have a similar style or idea to what you want to do for viticulture?
I think on the way that for viticulture, I mean, we, as far as I know, are the only domain that are biodynamic at the moment. Mm-hmm. And we've been farming our vineyards for 3 years biodynamically. I was surprised when we chose to do that. We at the moment work with a wonderful consultant called Mathieu Boucher. His father, François Boucher, was one of the instrumental people in the world to promote farming biodynamically, not just necessarily in a vineyard, but for food crops as well. And I had the fortune to work with François before he passed away in Tuscany at a small estate that I worked at for a year. And I think we've found a huge change to our vineyards, farming them biodynamically, in regards to the level of ripeness of the tannins and the sugars and the vitality of these soils. We were surprised. We wanted to get a group of neighbouring producers to work with France, with Mathieu as well, because I think, you know, I've seen in other regions and in France, you know, particularly in the Loire, you know, once there's at least four, five, six of you working a certain way, you can do your preps together, you can bounce ideas off, you can say, I've got this issue in this vineyard, or this weed, or this herb, what are you doing? We haven't actually found any of our neighbours that are wanting to share or do that work with us. So we've, at the moment, just continuing the way that we think we should.
Also, I imagine it helps with the general air and soil quality if your neighbours are doing it also in a biodynamic way.
I think so. I mean, all of the vineyards that we own are very isolated. Some of them are surrounded completely by trees and lava. We'd never have any problems of where we've chosen our vineyards of any cross-contamination. I think back to the second part to your question, I think Etna is very lucky that it's very windy. There's an incredible luminosity. There's incredible light there. So there's actually naturally very low disease pressure. And then also there's the wonderful thing, in my opinion, that a lot of the old vineyards that have been farmed by not my generation, but by the generation before me, so sort of gentlemen or people that are in their sort of 70s to 90s, let's say, when they were farming the vineyards, and they actually didn't have the money or access to chemicals. So I think a lot of vineyards of the old Albarello have actually often always been farmed organically compared to other regions. And I think there's, with the light, the low disease pressure, it is possible for most people to at least be farming biodynamically and, you know, in an ideal world, more people moving to biodynamically.
And so you take control of the winemaking. I imagine that being a certified biodynamic winemaker, you're doing an ambient yeast fermentation. Is this the first time in your career you'd worked with ambient yeast, or had you done it previously, and was it challenging for you?
No, I think taking control, I don't think I take control.
Oh, okay. Sorry to mischaracterize.
I think, you know, Eric and I we bounce ideas back. I think when there's sort of various scientific things that need to be, you know, lab analysis and, but no, definitely we both share the winemaking thing and we often have different micro vinifications that I'll be sort of like, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way. But he'll go, oh yeah, we're going to do that. And I'll have my sort of little Mustoloni or that doing a different idea to his, you know, next door and sort of, mm-hmm. So we sort of compare and contrast. But yes, I mean, ambient yeast to us is fundamental. It was not easy the first few years to use the yeast from the vineyards because, you know, how the vineyards had been farmed, they may have used some fertilizers or they may have used some pesticides that, you know, we needed to get out of the soils to have a more healthy ambient yeast population for our fermentations to work. And I think farming biodynamically, the last vintage we just had in 2018 were the best fermentations we've ever had. So I think we've finally got there using the compost and the preparations to have very healthy soils in our vineyards. But it wasn't the first indigenous yeast fermentations. That was another thing that I forgot to mention back at Unalaya. All the fermentations at Unalaya that we did were with ambient yeast.
And they were a spontaneous fermentation?
Yeah, spontaneous fermentations. Wow. And spontaneous malo. I'm not sure what they are today, but this was, you know, in 2001 mm-hmm. to 2004, which was my last vintage. And that was very much Thomas Dureau coming with his experience from France and saying, no, look, you know, we're going to actually make the wines this way.
I didn't know that. So there must be some level of good, healthy farming in order to create a strong yeast population, even
definitely.
At Ornellaia. Yeah. You also make a skin macerated white wine or an orange wine. Can you tell us about that?
I can. I'm just trying to think. It depends on which year because we're not an easy
not
winery.
Always.
We change
the Bianco's
quite regularly.
It's always a conversation with my staff here. You said and it's on. I know on the your website and on Indie Wineries, it says this is a white wine. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's not fair to be saying that it's an orange wine. I'm not sure.
No, it depends. I'm trying to think of which vintage you have because we keep changing how we're making and dealing with our white wines. So we make, as of today, we make three, maybe four white wines. We make a Parmento Bianco. There's this wonderful variety on Etna called Grecanico, but particularly Grecanico Dorato, which are these long, lean bunches of white grapes that we discovered in a very high vineyard at 1,000 meters that go golden in the vineyard. And so we decided when we accessed fruit from this vineyard a few years ago to do a skin maceration on that, sometimes 8 days, sometimes 10 days, and then we'll blend it with some of the other indigenous whites we have, like Catarato and Insolia, that don't have as much interesting characteristics in the skins. So one of our white, our Parmento Bianco, some of it's skin macerated. And the wine that you're referring to is Vino di Anna Bianco and a G, and the G again standing for Grecanico. When we can from certain vineyards, they're actually red vineyards of Nerello Mascalese that are co-planted with Grecanico in them. When the year permits, we'll go and source small quantities of Grecanico from those vineyards and skin macerate that. We've managed to do that in 15, 16 and 17. In 18, I'm hesitating because we didn't manage to do that just because of the conditions of the harvest.
What about the harvest? What about the year makes it a good candidate for some skin maceration?
I think the fruit has to be healthy, 100% healthy. I mean, there can't be any mold. There can't be any damage to the skin of the grapes itself. Sadly, in 2018, 2019, we got hit by hail, and some vineyards, our key white vineyard, we got hailed on 3 times. So one vineyard, we didn't get pick a grape. There was nothing left. And the key vineyard we have, Vigna Nave, which is a beautiful vineyard at 1,200 metres of altitude, which normally Vino d'Anno Bianco comes from. We normally probably get about, let's say, 2,000 and a half, nearly 3,000 kilos of fruit, and we received about 500 kilos of fruit. It's delicious. It's amazing what we received, but, you know, we didn't have the chance to do skin maceration. What was there had been, you know, so badly hit, we just needed to whole bunch press it straight away. We're still, you know, each year we kind of change of what we do, and, you know, we do have these cuvées, and obviously the historically in Georgia, it's to do a skin maceration of white in a cuvée, and we're yet to do that at this stage. We don't have a huge amount of white fruit, and we've found it's easier for us to handle it in either a big plastic tub called a mustaloni or stainless steel than in the quavery.
I thought it was fascinating how in Georgia the decision when to take the wine off the skins or to open up the quavery was sort of predetermined. They would choose someone's birthday or an anniversary or a holiday and say, okay, we'll open up the quavery in 6 months, but not because I think 6 months is the right amount of time, but because this is a special day that we've chosen, and it's
beautiful that the traditions really that they have. I think, you know, all of us that are sometimes in a rush commercially to have wines on the market and feel sort of the pressure that we need to get things out, you know, need to take a leaf out of the Georgians, and definitely need to take a leaf out of people like Pierre Auvernois that say, you know, what's the rush? You have time, you know, honor the process.
Well, thank you so much. We absolutely love serving your wine here at Fausto. My only gripe is that we can't buy enough because you've done such a good job. But when we do have them in-house, I know not only for myself, but the whole team is so happy and proud to sell your wine. So thank you so much for being guest on In the Drink.
Oh, Joey, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your support. It's really a privilege to be here.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening to In the Drink. Again, I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. You can follow me on Instagram at Joe Campanelli for updates on the show, photos of what I'm drinking, and the occasional pit bull pick. You can also email me at info@inthedrinkpod.com. And please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. In the Drink is produced by our very talented producer, Jasmine Molly, and a huge thanks to Alyssa Satter for her help with promo for the show. Special thanks goes to Renny Lopez for the awesome theme music. And last, but by no means least, thank you so much for listening. Join us for another episode next week of In the Drink.